February 13th meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to Order. And we hope that we're going to be joined by a few more members shortly. I know that Majority Leader Hunt called me a little while ago and said that there was a big wreck on a freeway that he was cut in, but he will be here soon. We'll also be joined not only by our usual members, but I know Representative Felicio will be here shortly too. So the bulk of our meeting will be devoted to presentations on the initiative process. We will not be having the update from the Elections Division on House Bill 2082 because we thought we wanted to devote the time to hearing from our citizen representatives who are here, and we'll do that at a later meeting. We also do have an item of business that we need to take care of, and that would be that we have two requests that have come before us. One, I think, comes from the members of this committee. One comes from elsewhere. And so what we're doing basically here is just requesting that the Speaker give us approval to have these two additional measures being drafted by Legislative Council, and then they would come back here to be introduced as bills. So I'll recognize Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we request the Speaker to approve a drafting of a legislative concept for introduction honoring Skip Knight, a recently deceased member of the Medford City Council.
Thank you. And Representative Buckley has moved that we request the Speaker to approve drafting of a legislative concept for introduction honoring Skip Knight, who was a recently deceased member of the Medford City Council. I believe this came to us from both Representatives Esquivel and Representative Buckley. Is there any discussion on that motion?
And just to say that we appreciate your consideration of this, and we look forward to moving forward with the memorial.
Great. And good morning, Representative Thatcher. We are actually on a motion to take care of a drafting request of a resolution honoring a recently deceased member of the Medford City Council. Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair.
Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move to request the Speaker to approve drafting of a legislative concept for introduction relating to Oregon's fair housing law.
Representative Buckley has moved that we request the Speaker to approve drafting of an LC for introduction relating to Oregon's fair housing law. And members, this is another sort of conformance issue with federal law relating to a bill that passed last session overwhelmingly. Just needs a few modifications. Is there any discussion on this motion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, thank you, members. We have done our business, and now we can move on to the fascinating topic of the initiative. This committee obviously spent a lot of time during the last legislative session talking about various ideas for the initiative process to be able to be made to work better for the citizens of Oregon, and passed what I think was a pretty landmark piece of legislation, which we did not all support, but did pass, and that's House Bill 2082. That's not mainly what we're going to be hearing about this morning, though. We will be hearing from two groups. First, we'll be hearing from Tyrone Reitman and Elliot Schuford of Healthy Democracy Oregon. And if you'd like to come forward, I understand that you have a PowerPoint presentation for us as well as some comments. Good morning, and welcome back to the House Elections Committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tyrone Reitman. I'm the co-director of Healthy Democracy Oregon. I currently live in Eugene, Oregon. I was raised in Silverton, Oregon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a real pleasure to be talking with you this morning. We've had the opportunity to talk with a number of you during the last session. I just wanted to acknowledge that, particularly thank Representative Buckley for his help on a session on the Citizens Initiative Review, which we're going to present on. Healthy Democracy Oregon was created in order to promote an innovative reform to the initiative process called the Citizens Initiative Review. I'm going to briefly discuss why we're working on this reform, and then turn it over to my colleague, Healthy Democracy Oregon's other co-director, Elliot Schuford, to discuss the process in more detail. As you all know, the initiative process was designed to allow voters to directly shape public policy in the public interest. In order to do this, voters must have access to high-quality information. We must be able to understand the issues of the day. And we must be able to determine whether a given ballot measure will really serve the public good. Often enough in ballot measure campaigns, both for and against, information is presented that's oftentimes spun, slanted, or at its worst, intentionally misleading. In much of the campaign literature and advertising, both for and against ballot measure campaigns, these complex issues, with all their associated trade-offs and gray areas, are often drastically oversimplified. Voters are left without a good understanding of what a given ballot measure will do, and oftentimes without the context on why it's on the ballot in the first place. Ultimately, it is we, the voting public, who are responsible for the choices that we make, and I want to make that really clear. The initiative process requires that voters take responsibility for the choices that are made come the election. However, given the extent to which public relations firms and political consultants dominate the information flow in ballot measure campaigns, many voters don't have sufficient information to truly evaluate the merits of ballot measures that come before us, and that's something that we find time and time again. And this is the real problem that the Citizens Initiative Review aims to address. The Citizens Initiative Review, or CIR, is designed to be a trustworthy, open public review process with widely publicized results. It would provide for better public understanding of the issues on the ballot and help Oregonians in making decisions on ballot measures. So to describe the CIR process in more detail, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Elliot Schubert.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elliot Schubert. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I was born and raised in Salem. The Citizens Initiative Review is based on the concept of deliberative democracy. Here the goal is to help the public move from a place of sort of off-the-cuff public opinion to a more stable place of informed public judgment, which is based on common sense, facts, and reason. I want to share a few general notes about good deliberative processes. One, they should include a diverse and representative sample of the public. A good process should include a balanced range of expertise and information. Participants learn about various policy options and the associated trade-offs and contextual issues, public values associated with those options. And a trained professional moderator helps walk people through the process. Now, there's a number of different models or approaches which incorporate those elements. The Citizens Initiative Review is based on a deliberative democracy model called the Citizens Jury, which has been in use since 1974, used in various policy settings. So here's an overview of the Citizens Initiative Review, vastly simplified, and I'll go into these in a little more detail in just a moment. For each statewide initiative measure on the ballot, a group of randomly selected registered voters is brought together. They deliberate for 3 to 5 days. Then they issue a concise statement about that measure that goes out into the voter's pamphlet. The group evaluates the process and then disbands. I should also note here that we see the Citizens Initiative Review ideally operating as a state-administered process operating under an independent commission within state government. So now more about the selection of the participants. A large pool of randomly selected registered voters is developed, and from that pool, a panel of 18 to 24 panelist members is assembled. Those panels are then balanced by certain demographics, including age, partisan affiliation, and location of residence, and perhaps other demographics as well. People are compensated for their time, travel, and lodging so that there's no significant barriers to participation. Now into a little more about the deliberations themselves. During the 3 to 5 day process, proponent and opponent teams have equal time to make their case. Each team gives direct sort of testimony. They also have an opportunity to bring in outside witnesses or experts to help make their case. In addition, there's a range of policy experts and or affected parties that are brought to the table to weigh in on the issue, and the public is invited to testify. So throughout the process, the citizen panelists ask questions. They have an opportunity to get all of their questions answered. They also have the opportunity to ask additional witnesses or experts to come in and give testimony, or also to ask witnesses to come back and explain any kind of an issue that they don't understand. This is particularly important if a particular expert makes a claim that's refuted by the other side. So they're able to kind of go back and say, well, these quite don't line up. Let's see what the real facts are here. During the process, participants make up their minds as to whether the ballot measure will do what proponents say it will do, and whether it's a good solution to a statewide problem. This is all part of an open public process that then feeds into the Citizens Initiative Review statement itself. So that statement is basically a concise one-page statement about that measure that goes into the voter's pamphlet. The statement contains the number of panelists who are for the measure and the reasons supporting sort of underlying that position. And then there's also the same goes for the panelists that are against the measure. So it kind of incorporates both those, has the number of panelists and then the reasons underlying that particular viewpoint. There's also space for any consensus or agreement of the whole panel, and if anyone is undecided at the end of the process, they have space to kind of articulate their position as well. So this statement goes up on the CIR website. It's distributed to the media and perhaps most importantly put into a prominent place in the voter's pamphlet. The statement is not written by campaigners or lawyers. It's not meant to be unbiased or values-free. Rather, public values on all sides are included. This is the key difference between the CIR statement and the current summary, explanatory statement, and fiscal impact statement that are in the voter's pamphlet. It's the voice of regular people written in everyday language with the goal of informing all Oregon voters. So some people have heard us talk about the Citizens Initiative Review and have essentially asked, well, the process sounds good. It's based on a good deliberative model, but what kind of an impact do you think that the statement itself is actually going to have? So last summer we worked with Davis Simpson Mitchell and asked a question. How much time do voters spend reading the voter's pamphlet? And you can see on the slide here, the 83% said they spent 30 minutes or more. So given that, just that piece alone, and given the efficiency of the one-page concise statement from a trustworthy source, we do feel that the Citizens Initiative Review statement would be read and considered by most voters. So we also followed up that question with the question of, well, did reading the voter's pamphlet have any impact on how you voted on the measures? And then again, kind of following on that, 67% said reading the voter's pamphlet changed their mind on at least a few initiatives. So, and I want to stress here that it doesn't take the entire electorate to sway an election. Obviously, a few percentage points can make or break a given vote. So we see the Citizens Initiative Review statement as a source of information, a trustworthy source of information that can tip the scales kind of towards common sense and reason, and that informed public deliberation that we were referring to earlier. So now Tyrone is going to finish up with some more polling data and information about the initiative process in general.
All right, thanks, Elliot. As a state, obviously, we've used the initiative process many times in its history, starting way back in 1902. It's well known that Oregonians value the initiative process, and as you can see on the slide before you, that the initiative process maintains a high level of support today when asked just a general question. You know, do you find, you know, are you satisfied with the initiative process? Just that kind of general question. We had this question asked last June, that same poll that Elliot referred to, and approximately 66% of respondents said, yes, I'm still satisfied with it. And we see that over time with various polls, roughly high 50s, low 60s, mid 60s. However, numerous studies in Oregon, California, Washington have all pointed to the fact that while voters support the initiative process by and large, there are many areas where improvements can be made. Most notably, some of the issues that come up in various pieces of research and polling for problems in the initiative process are a lack of understanding. Voters don't feel that they have enough information to truly assess the measures on the ballot. There's a sense of buyer's remorse, which is fresh in everyone's mind, particularly around Measure 37, where voters passed a measure and later learned more about it and had misgivings after the fact. There are studies done on the misunderstood aspects of ballot titles, where voters can vote for something they're intending to support and actually be voting against the proposal in the way that they intended. There's also disturbingly a skepticism of public judgment that's prevalent in a number of polls that I've seen, where when asked if a voter feels that voters at large are making informed choices, they generally don't think so. There's also a cynicism about the role of special interest and money in the initiative process, which should be no surprise given how much money there is in the process. So with that said, our goal in promoting the CIR is to add value to the initiative process by empowering citizens to take the lead role in evaluating ballot measures. We think that by relying upon a cross-section of everyday citizens to provide additional information to voters statewide, information that comes from a solid and trustworthy source, we feel that the CIR is a practical way to improve the initiative process, and our polling and research data shows that voters do like the idea. Before we conclude, I want to quickly address our next steps in developing the CIR. We often find in discussions about this process that the idea of bringing together a cross-section of randomly selected citizens to deliberate on policies spurns numerous questions such as, you know, can everyday citizens tackle these complex issues? How can a public process be run in a fair and trustworthy manner? And as Ellie had already mentioned, will this process have an impact on the vote? Our own research points to the efficacy and viability of the CIR as a reform of the initiative process. However, references and research pales in comparison to seeing the real thing. So while we look forward to answering any of your questions today, we also want you to know that we'll be demonstrating the CIR process in very early fall on one of the measures that's on the ballot for this November's election. So we invite you to attend the demonstration process, watch how it works, follow the results, and examine the evaluations that are done after the process has been concluded. And with that, I want to thank you for the opportunity to present today, and we look forward to answering any of your questions.
Great. Well, thanks a lot. This is certainly actually very professionally presented, and I know that we had some discussion about these ideas in this committee during session, so it's obviously moved ahead. Members, we have another presentation, but I think we do have a few minutes for questions and comments. Yes, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that you want to keep our comments short because we do have other information to receive today. I just wanted to compliment the two gentlemen for their efforts on this. You've taken the idea and you've really kept moving with it, and I appreciate all the work you put in, and please do keep me informed of the process in the fall. I definitely would like to be part of it.
Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Yeah, thank you, gentlemen. I'll be interested in your experiment, very interested. Is it by email that you intend to communicate with us specifically on this process, or did you have something else in mind? I'm just wanting to know where to look.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, we can communicate by email. We're also going to try to publicize the results and invite members of this committee to the presentation to watch it as it's actually taking place. And it'll probably take place in the valley. So,
I guess I'm just a little worried that I'll miss it. Okay. If you're expecting me to pick it up in the press that you're doing this.
Oh, no.
So a more direct invite by way of email would be welcome.
Certainly.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I was just wondering what experience you gentlemen have had as far as directly being involved in an initiative campaign, or otherwise being a chief petitioner, or being a proponent, or any of that. I just wonder what your experiences have been from that. Have you been involved at that level?
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher. I've worked on a number of ballot initiative campaigns. I'm not as a chief petitioner. But I have seen the process from the inside. It was actually through that experience that really led me to look at the different reform possibilities that are out there and really explore the gambit of reforms from those advocated by the Portland City Club in the earlier report, looking at the National Conference of State Legislators in their report, looking at studies in California. And after a process of evaluating a lot of those different ideas, came to this one. And thought this was a really good idea to reform the process in a way the voters would support.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Policio, welcome to the Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee.
Well, thank you very much. Sorry I was late. 8 o'clock is early. gentlemen, thank you very much. I have one question for clarification and then one other question. In the description, it's number 6, it says independent oversight. We talk about the independent commission within state government. And then number 7 says nonpartisan oversight. It's overseen by a nonpartisan commission. So my question is, are we talking about, is that the same commission that you're talking about? You're just using nonpartisan and independent. And then my second question is, one of your goals is to decrease the influence of special interests in Oregon politics. So the panel met, the 18 to 24 people assembled for the panels, do you envision that they would be permitted, or how would they be governed in terms of contributions that might be given to them from the various groups?
Madam Chair, Representative Luizio,
There's a couple different responses. So one, we do see it as an independent commission, and it has sort of the commission as we've proposed it right now has kind of four different kinds of seats on it. One set is political appointments brought by both parties, so there's political balance for that group. One is a group of former moderators of the process, and the other group is former citizen panelists. So we see that as being the commission structure itself, and that kind of gives the citizens and people that understand the process a big role in kind of shaping how that commission works. So you might describe it as nonpartisan. We do see it as an independent commission, and that would be within state government. It wouldn't necessarily be under a particular office. As far as the protections that are afforded for the panelists, the same rules and protections that apply to public servants and to jurors in the way that we've proposed it are afforded for those individuals. So the same penalties for bribing a juror, for instance, would be in place. So that there would be a penalty for trying to interfere in the process, the same as with a jury.
Thanks for those questions. And I had a question about the timing of this. So since we have sometimes had lots of initiatives, sometimes had not so many, do you see this group convening in one block of time to hear all of the initiatives that have qualified for the ballot, or how do you see that working?
Chair Rosenbaum, we've looked kind of carefully at that and met with the elections division to try to understand how that timing could work. So some of the planning would go on before measures had actually qualified, so assembling that pool, for instance. And to be clear, there would be a panel for each measure. So if there were 10 measures, then there'd be 10 panels. Those would be stacked up through the month of August and into the first part of September, so they'd bump right up against the deadline for printing the voters' pamphlet. And as I understand it, there is an effort going on to try to update or modernize the process of doing the voters' pamphlet, so I don't know if that might affect that deadline for print. That might be able to be pushed out a little bit. So we see that as a tight timeline, and if there were a great deal of initiatives, it would be an undertaking to do all the reviews during that time period, but a lot of the work can be done up front ahead of time.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a minor detail, except that it is similar to a jury process, and I know that when juries are impaneled, that's one of the worst times of the year to try to get people to serve on juries. That's partly probably because lawyers like to go on vacation, and so do judges, but I think that's a challenge and a detail that we would have to think about, is just how would the availability work. And yeah. Okay, any other questions or comments? Well, thanks very much for being here, and as Representative Berger said, I'm sure we will be fascinated to be able to participate in your trial run, so please do keep us posted when that happens. And thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And we do look forward to meeting with members of this committee and explaining our progress as we go along and closer to the demonstration. So.
Great. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Just one more question. Yes, okay, Representative Esquivel.
We were looking feverishly through the information to Representative Buckley and I. Now, these people that are randomly selected throughout the state, will that be done by geographical selection or... I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't feel real good if everyone came from Portland.
Or Medford.
Absolutely. we don't want them from Ashland.
Better initiative.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Esquivel. The process would be a simple random sample to start to build the initial pool, and then from that pool, certain demographics, including location of residence, would be balanced out to be reflective of the state. So the idea would be kind of a microcosm, if you will, of the state within that panel of 18 to 24. So there'd be representatives, citizen representatives from the southern part of the state or the eastern part of the state, for instance. It wouldn't all be Portland, in other words.
Okay. Thanks again.
Thanks.
And next we have a panel from the City Club of Portland who will be presenting a report that they worked on over a period of months. I'll call forward Wade Fickler and David Cannon, Richard York, and I believe, is there someone else who will be presenting? No. Okay. And I also, if anybody is listening to this, not in the hearing room, want to mention that the same witnesses that we just heard, as well as the ones we're about to hear, will also be appearing this afternoon at
3:30 in front of the Senate Elections Committee, so there will be two opportunities. And if any members are really, really fascinated by this topic and through this afternoon, they'd be able to have another crack at it this afternoon, because I'm sure Senator Brown would be pleased to have people join in there as well. So we really appreciate you spending the day with us here in Salem, and we are eagerly looking forward to your presentation. And then I think we will have a fair amount of time. We're planning to go until 9:30 this morning. So okay. Please go ahead.
Are you ready? Well, take just a moment.
Okay. I'm sure while they're sitting up, I think Mr. Cannon, who's appearing before us, bears a significant responsibility in that his son is a representative in the House.
Uh-huh.
And so I
in the interest of full disclosure.
In full disclosure, don't know if he wants to apologize in advance or.
Nothing like having my credibility.
Those cut off money at the start. There, sir.
Yes, but you may not realize that the City Club Study Committee process is a confidential process, and during the course of our 2 years of work, I wasn't allowed to even talk with him about this. So you're getting a very independent source.
Great, and as you start presenting, we do need you to identify yourself so the record will
be on here. We're just getting our technology.
It's not seeing this.
There it is.
Sorry, we're having a little trouble with the.
It's never happened before here, Joe. This is the very first time it's ever happened.
We'd be broke down for the day.
That's when I got lost on the way to the community room, then, I'm sure.
Yeah, you did.
Took the wrong turn. We can go this way.
Heavy wound, sir.
Yeah,
it's coming up higher than.
I love it. Here we go. Perfect. Thanks.
Here we go.
Yeah,
the light didn't even flash before.
And members, we are in the process of posting an agenda for Friday morning. We'll be meeting Friday at 8:30. We won't be meeting on Thursday. And then I would anticipate probably meeting every day after that, because we don't have very many days remaining until the deadline of the 21st, which is a week from tomorrow, of getting all bills in all committees completed.
Let's wait a second. It's been pretty slow.
Yes.
I was wondering if the individuals here to testify would like to have a DVD of this so you could play it over and over and over again.
We can get you an edited version.
There you go, the edited version.
Okay. I think we're close to being there.
Because we don't need the slides.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Buckley. Vice Chair Berger has excused herself. I see members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wade Fickler. I'm acting executive director of the City Club of Portland. I'm here to sit today with two City Club members, David Cannon and Richard York, who are among the 10 members who produced the report that we're here to discuss. I'd also like to recognize Leslie Johnson, Vice Chair of our committee, who is in the back of the room. David and Rick will walk you through a 20-minute presentation of our report. They'll focus on the conclusions and recommendations the committee drew and were later adopted by City Club last month. Before they do that, I'll say just a few words about the path that led us here today. A little more than 2 years ago, City Club embarked on an effort to update a 1996 report on the initiative and referendum system. The outcome of that effort is this new standalone report that you have. The report builds on the history documented in the 1996 report and includes new conclusions and new recommendations that take into account events of the last dozen years. The report was produced by 10 City Club members, all of whom were screened for conflict of interest, and David will say a little bit more about the study process in his remarks. In the months since the report was released, it has produced news coverage, editorials, op-eds, blog postings, and discussions around the state, both in rural and urban areas. The role of the initiative is on the minds of Oregonians, and many people are concerned about the status quo. As you consider the many voices you hear on this subject, I urge you to avoid the common mistake of assuming that the initiative reform is a partisan issue. It is not, unless we make it one. The debate is more accurately between those who are satisfied with the system as it is and those who are not. And these positions do not belong to one party or the other. City Club believes firmly that the initiative system has a proper place in lawmaking in Oregon. The system is worth keeping and worth improving. Thank you for giving your attention to this topic. Reforming Oregon's initiative and referendum system is of utmost importance to the economic and social fabric of our state and the well-being of its citizens. And now David will walk you through the high points of the report, and then we'll take your questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Vice Chair Buckley and Vice Chair Berger in absentia, we're really very pleased and honored at your invitation to have us here to share with you kind of a brief overview of the report, which I believe you were given. We won't be able to obviously go into all the detail here, but you'll get more from the executive summary that you have and from the report itself than what we'll be able to cover here. But we will try to hit the main highlights. First of all, our charge as a committee of about a dozen people, including the staff, was really to focus on a couple things. The research and documentation about the use of the initiative and referendum, especially in the last 10 years since the previous City Club report, and also to examine changes in any relevant laws and court decisions regarding the initiative and referendum, and then to look at all of that and the public testimony and to develop new findings, conclusions, and recommendations. We also kept abreast of what was happening during the 2 years that we were working on this. Time didn't stand still, and in fact, House Bill 2082, which addressed some very specific concerns about the process, really affected our final recommendations. We were able to eliminate a couple of the recommendations we'd originally made because you effectively took care of it, it seemed, in that legislation. A brief word or two on our methodology, which consisted really of reviewing written material, and then the bulk of our work was interviews with a very large number of individuals who are listed in the back of the report. As far as material, we looked at scholarly research, historical data, not just from Oregon, but from many of the 23 other states which have an initiative and referendum of one sort or another. News coverage, public documents, and of course prior City Club research. Now, in our interviews, the number of people we spoke with was very large, but also they were a broad spectrum of opinion. I won't go through all the categories up there on the board. You can look on the screen. You can look for yourself. But it was not only diverse in terms of their positions and their perspectives, but we had regional balance. We talked to individuals from rural Oregon as well as from the Willamette Valley. We found, as Wade alluded to, that this wasn't really a partisan issue. In fact, there are people identifying themselves as conservatives who are very much in favor of the type of changes that we're recommending, and others who are not in support of those. Same thing with people self-identifying as progressives, if you will, that some of the staunchest supporters of the initiative system, as unrestricted as it currently is, are from that end of the political spectrum, as are some of those who would like to see significant changes. So we felt we had quite a diversity of opinion, and we added, as we went on, we extended our process. We invited people we hadn't originally planned on in order to really get as full a picture as possible. Okay. As I noted before, I'm just going to summarize some of the arguments that we heard and the opinions expressed. In doing so, I'm not expressing my opinion or at this point necessarily even the City Club's opinion, but I want to first, before we get to our conclusions, give you a brief summary of what we heard, I think, from these many individuals. First of all, arguments for the initiative and referendum system itself. I think they really boil down to two basic areas. Direct democracy, and that's a term that's often used to describe citizen lawmaking, as it's exemplified in the initiative and referendum in Oregon, is democratic government in its purest and highest form, according to many individuals, and is in fact superior to a strictly representative government. That is a widely held opinion, especially in Oregon. Obviously, there are 26 states in which they have only representative lawmaking, but we are not one of those. Second general area of support for our initiative and referendum system, as we have in our Constitution now, is that it is an integral part of Oregon's political system. It's traditional, it's held very dearly by many people in the state, and it should not be weakened or abolished. Now, what about concerns that were expressed? I guess I've already indicated that these concerns came from really the ones that I'm going to mention, which we've highlighted as really the most important ones today. We heard them from a lot of different types of individuals. So let me just go through the types of concerns about the status quo, the system as it's functioning right now. First, that it offers minimal opportunities for effective compromise and deliberation. And this really relates to the efficacy of this lawmaking process as compared to a more deliberative legislative process and of the place of our laws in the context of existing laws, something that is very much part of your work but not necessarily seen in the initiative as a means of lawmaking. Another very important concern, which the gentleman from CIR alluded to, was the negative consequences of poorly drafted initiatives, which sometimes frustrate the chief sponsors, chief petitioners, as well as those who were not in favor of the measures, that we often see years of confusion, very costly confusion, often litigation, due to unexpected consequences of the way these things were drafted. Another area of broad concern from people all over the political spectrum is that our Constitution has become replete with laws of a statutory nature. We have often taken ordinary temporal matters and put them beyond the reach of the legislature and of future legislatures by ingraining them enshrining them in our Constitution. The impact on the state's financial health is a broad area of concern, and one we'll go into a little more detail when we talk about our conclusions. There's great concern about the commercialization of the ballot measure process. And what we mean by that, it's not just the fact that there's money in politics, in ballot measure politics as well as elective politics, but really commercialization of almost an industry has spun up around ballot measures in several states, such as Oregon. I think you know about it. I won't go into more detail now, but there's a lot of concern among even the general public about the commercialization of this process with firms that are engaged, many of them from out of state, in working in this business and how that affects the outcome of it. There are, of course, concerns about the integrity of the signature gathering process, and I realize this is an area that was to some extent addressed by HB 2082. Likewise, the ballot certification process, and we've obviously had recent litigation on that question, but it's certainly there are many other concerns that are still unanswered about ballot certification. So these are the type of concerns that we heard. you may find that not all of them are directly addressed by the recommendations that we're going to discuss today, but please, we hope you will look at the report and see some of what we're not addressing today as well. In summary, we really felt that our challenge and everyone's challenge, if we're going to take a good fresh look at this, is to find an appropriate balance between the role of elected lawmakers and the citizenry ourselves in the making of written law. Okay, let me go right to our conclusions, the ones that we're highlighting today is probably the most significant to draw to your attention. There are more, but number one, and these are not necessarily in order of importance, but I think this one should come first. The City Club's position is that the Oregon initiative system as it currently operates is on balance a negative for the state. However, we feel it's important that Oregonians retain for themselves an initiative pathway when the legislature proves to be unwilling or unable to act on certain critical issues. Secondly, the Oregon legislature has always been and rightly continues to be the state's principal means to lawmaking. However, we find that relatively easy access to the initiative and referendum system has weakened the state's legislative process and has lessened public appreciation for that process. I don't need to acquaint you with the results of polling about the legislature's image. I don't necessarily put total credibility in those numbers, but it's something we heard about considerably, and we do feel there's a link to the preponderance of initiative and referendum in lawmaking here. Also, the initiative and referendum system has decreased, in some ways, we feel, the will and the ability of the legislature to resolve significant policy and budget matters. And that, in turn, leads to even more reliance on the initiative and referendum and referrals. So it's kind of a vicious circle. Another conclusion, in looking at other states around the country and how the system is functioning there, we find that the use of a so-called indirect initiative, which we'll describe in a few minutes, in other states reflects a very widely held view that state legislatures ought to be involved in the initiative process. Now, conclusion number four relates to what I think is a bit of an anomaly that you are well acquainted with. In as much as current law requires a 3/5 majority of the legislature to enact statutory revenue measures. But by some legal interpretations, the same threshold is required to refer statutory revenue measures to voters. The supermajority requirement creates an inappropriate incentive for legislators to refer to voters as constitutional amendments revenue bills that failed in the legislature, since the referral of a constitutional amendment requires only a majority vote of the legislature. Poorly drafted measures produce significant, often negative, unintended consequences. Number six, to preempt the possibility of repeal by the legislature, the Oregon Constitution has been amended repeatedly in ways that would have been more appropriately addressed by legislative statutory enactment. And finally, the last two conclusions are these. Mandating changes in revenue and expenditures through the initiative system has disrupted the state's budgeting process. It tends to confound the legislature's constitutional requirement to balance the budget, and it negatively affects state and local bond ratings. And in that sense, it's costing a good deal of money to all Oregon taxpayers. Finally, a degree of inherent unreliability and lack of context for the financial impact statements really limits the voters' ability to make informed choices about ballot measures with significant fiscal impacts. Okay, those being among the major conclusions of our 2 years of work and of listening, we came up with a set of recommendations. We feel that these recommendations are targeted A few of them are very broad and would probably require constitutional amendments. Most of them, in fact, do not. We hope that these will prove to be doable. Let me more quickly go through these recommendations, and then we'll open it to questions. Number one. Limit initiatives proposing constitutional amendments to matters involving the structure, powers, and limitations of government or the rights of the people with respect to their government. Number two, for any amendment to the Oregon Constitution, require approval by a 3/5 majority of the votes cast. We're talking about the election votes. Whether that amendment was proposed by initiative or by legislative referral. Number three, for revenue measures proposed by the legislature, as long as state law continues to require a 3/5 majority to directly enact a statutory revenue measure or refer one to the voters, require the same 3/5 voting requirement on the legislature when referring revenue measures as constitutional amendments, and thereby eliminate the incentive to put those measures in the Constitution rather than as statutes. Number four relates to what I alluded to as the indirect initiative system. We are proposing that an indirect initiative system be adopted. This would have two main parts. The first is that the legislature would be required to hold hearings for all citizen initiatives, presumably after they've qualified for the ballot. We believe that currently this can be done, but not always, because of the timing where you can qualify and then go straight to a vote without a legislative session in between. So that would be a change, that initiatives would get hearings in this place, in this way, public hearings. The second part of it is that the legislature would have certain options. These options are available today, but because it would go through the legislature first, these options would exist in all cases. First of all, a statutory initiative that comes to you could be enacted into law simply as proposed, in which case there'd be no need for us to vote on it. Or, in the case of a constitutional initiative, of course, you couldn't adopt it. It would simply go to the voters as proposed if the legislature chose to let it do so, without any alternatives. However, any initiative, and this is really the key to this proposal, any initiative which the legislature rejects or ignores will still go to the voters in the next general election. In other words, we're not suggesting, and when this system that's used in six other states, it does not provide a veto for the legislature. And that's not been clear in some of the comments that have made negatively regarding the citizen the initiative proposals of the City Club. There would be no veto. If you don't act on it, if you ignore it, or if you reject it, it would still go to the ballot. However, the legislature could enact a different law on the same subject, as you have done in recent instances, or are considering now, in fact, from what we hear. Or you could refer a competing alternative to the voters alongside the original. This is something that we've seen has happened in, not frequently, but in some very significant cases in several other states, where you perhaps feel that it's the original initiative is poorly drafted, but you're going to support the concept and let the voters have that that say on the matter. You can redraft the thing, put it out there, and the voters would have their choice then. But in no way would you eliminate the one that the chief petitioners have proposed. They might decide they don't want to push it, but it wouldn't be up to the legislature to simply take it off the ballot. So that's the indirect initiative. There are several more recommendations, and then we will be finished here. The legislature should strike ORS 250.035, paragraph 6, and make clear that the Attorney General should assign the same ballot title to substantively identical proposed measures. This is really more in the matter of a technical cleanup, but it would save some confusion and a fair amount of time and money if in the whole ballot title shopping process that we now see. Along the same lines, we're recommending that instead of the Supreme Court hearing all appeals to ballot measure titles, which we were able to get them to document is really a very considerable amount of work for the Supreme Court itself, that this job of hearing those appeals be assigned to retired senior judges who have volunteered under Plan B of the Judicial Retirement System to take on some extra work, that they hear these challenges to the ballot measure titles, and their decisions would be final and binding. We recommend that all proposed ballot measures be submitted to the Legislative Council for assistance in clarifying and drafting prior to the circulation of those measures. Now, here again, the chief petitioners would maintain control of their measures. They don't have to go along with the Legislative Council, but they would have essentially the same requirement you do to go to the council and see if they want to take the draft that comes out of there. And finally, we recommend that the state direct additional financial and personnel resources to proactive and vigorous enforcement of the regulations that govern signature gathering. We have some pretty good laws. They don't seem to be being enforced very vigorously. Finally, I just want to note once again that the City Club would like to emphasize that reforming Oregon's initiative system is not a partisan issue. We believe that the process of reforming the system is well worth the effort it would require to make these changes. We think our recommendations are pragmatic, although some of them are a significant change from the status quo. We feel that measures that reach the voters deserve more thoughtful, better informed attention than they currently receive. And one of our general themes, obviously, is that these proposed fixes to the system are in part meant to avoid embedding more statutory subject matter in the Oregon Constitution. We think that's particularly important. So with that, I think we are open to your questions, and I thank you very much for your patient hearing of our recommendations, conclusions, and so forth.
Wow. Great. Well, thanks very much for all the work that went into this. I'm certain that it will be a topic of discussion, as it already has been. And we do have, I think, about half an hour, but I know that Representative Hunt is going to have to leave shortly. So would you like to ask a question?
That would be great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all for the excellent work on this. I will confess, in general, I'm not a big fan of supermajority requirements on anything, although I think actually the case you make in terms of supermajorities for the Constitution is a good idea and would be consistent with what we do at the federal level. Help me reconcile, though, the fact, unlike with the federal Constitution, where from the start there has been a supermajority requirement to amend it, so anything that's been added or taken away has been consistently under that standard. With the Oregon Constitution, where we've added item after item after item with a simple majority over time, it seems like there's an imbalance with voters' ability to change something that was put in with a simple majority by having a supermajority. If we were having a constitutional convention, seriously, and going back to a pure constitution to start with, and then imposing the supermajority requirement, that would seem to make sense. But how do you reconcile those two?
Can
you
take that?
Yeah?
No. Well, that has definitely been a concern that we've heard since this report was issued. In fact, I'll share with you that at the City Club meeting where the club adopted this this report and recommendation by an almost unanimous vote, one person who stood up, the one person who spoke on the opposition side of the room, brought up the same issue. She thought this was great, but she has some issues that she'd like to see taken out of the Constitution and doesn't want to have to go get a 3/5 vote to do it. There are those that are suggesting that that the legislature might think about revision work to the Constitution that would clean that up, but that's really beyond the scope of our work, so it would only be personal opinion if we got into that.
And there's also usually what's embedded in there.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, the other issue that is addressed in this report is that the fact that we have loaded the Constitution up with so many constitutionally irrelevant issues. And if there are, the best way to handle this would be to pass a constitutional amendment that says this Constitution only applies to the structure and the rights of the people, and any other changes addressing any other subject will not be permitted. And then the majority vote would be fine. With the openness that currently exists in the Constitution, the three-fifths at least brings some element of control into what goes into the Constitution. That's the main reason for it. That was our main rationale. Since we don't have restrictions on what can be put into the Constitution, we should make it a little harder. And I don't know if that answers your problem directly, but that was my thinking, and there it is. Thanks.
Right, and I actually had a related question to that, which is that and I haven't done a statistical analysis of this, but it appears that lately the voters themselves have somewhat lost their appetite for constitutional amendments, so that some of what you seem to be recommending may be happening, and obviously you saw this in what I think is the unfortunate well-funded campaign against the healthcare cigarette tax proposal, but largely that campaign was built around this shouldn't be in the Constitution and you should reject it. So what do you think about whether people just on their own are coming to the conclusion that we've used the constitutional amendment inappropriately and they're just starting to reject proposals on that basis?
I would suggest that if the citizens at large are reaching that conclusion, then this might be the time to act on it in a legislative fashion. But in other words, the environment might be right to address it.
And I suppose this is one of those sort of conundrums, which the only way to do that would be to convince people by a constitutional amendment that they should take away their own right to make that decision.
So. In fact, yes.
And I think that is one of the challenges of what we're talking about with this whole topic, is that, you know, Oregonians do hold this process very sacred, I believe. And you could see that in the polling that was done by the previous panel, that even though people are grumpy about it, they still, by and large, believe it's an essential feature of our democracy. So to some extent, there is a question at the end of this statement. This is, though, in the eyes of the beholder, that people like me who have used the initiative process when they couldn't get a minimum wage proposal heard by the legislature would say we needed to be able to do that, and I'm sure people like Kevin Mannix, who believe they can't necessarily get what they want out of the legislature, would argue vociferously, as they have in this room, that we shouldn't be doing much of anything to change the process. So.
Our research aligns well with that of the previous presenters, in that we did find that people do hold the initiative system near and dear, and but I would say less high regard than Oregonians once did, and that there is room here for improvement, and that talk of abolishing the system
I think that's why we've tried to emphasize, Madam Chair, that we're really talking about enhancing our initiative process. Again, it's why when I talked about the indirect initiative, I really want to emphasize that this is not to weaken or give any legislative veto to the process. It can still initiate with citizen, and no matter how it's written, it will go to the voters, unless you adopt it yourselves. And so we're particularly concerned that what is being proposed here should not be seen as attacking that which is held sacred in Oregon, but really maybe as a way of dealing with what I think the previous witnesses showed quite clearly after citing the poll, that people generally, you know, like the system, but then the next slide was the real concerns that people are expressing about it. No, they don't want to lose it, but there's, you know, quite a bit more, I guess, concern. And you mentioned one area about the Constitution than maybe there was 10 years ago. I think that's probably the biggest change that the City Club experienced over those 10 years, is just a broader voice of concern.
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your excellent work. On your recommendations, I have a lot of questions, but I'll try to not to take too much time with the committee. Recommendation on limiting initiatives, proposing constitutional amendments to matters involving the structure, powers, and limitations, etc. Let me take an example. My colleague from Medford is working with the commission that is looking at our revenue stream from the state, and one of the proposals is a 5% sales tax that has been suggested that would be part of a package, and that 5% sales tax would go into the Constitution. So only a vote of the people could change that limit. That 5% sales tax would not, if I'm reading this correctly, would not rise to the level, or would it? That's my question. Would it rise to that level that we're stating or not?
I think I can represent the views of our committee in saying that it would not. In fact, just to give you a little personal experience, before I became a teacher, and actually I did fail to identify myself, I've been in education, I live in Southwest Portland. My name is David Cannon. Sorry for not doing that earlier. I worked with two state governments, in particular one, and it would have been inconceivable in those states and in those legislatures to think of a sales tax legislation as something to put in the Constitution. It just didn't occur. It wasn't part of the political discourse. Now, I'm not saying which is right or wrong, but what we're talking about here is in keeping with constitutional tradition in some states, and certainly in the federal Constitution. Congress didn't put most of our taxes into the Constitution, and really neither have the majority of states. So in Oregon, we do have this tradition, and I think what we're suggesting is let's look at the thing with some fresh eyes and see how we want our Constitution to be in the future. And really, we're hoping that people will have this debate. Should sales taxes be constitutional? Should the legislature be preempted from ever changing the rate of that sales tax to reflect changing economic conditions, for example?
Can you follow, won't you?
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you for that answer. On another one of your recommendations on the indirect initiative system, which I find a fascinating idea, let's take the current example that we have with the property crimes initiative that's going on. Under your recommendation, if there was a proposal that is roughly the same as the proposal that has the same series, it looks like it's going to qualify for the ballot, but not exactly the same proposal, that original proposal would still have to go to the ballot. There'd be no sign off from the chief petitioner. What are your thoughts on that?
In fact, implementation of these things we really intentionally left to you, or perhaps to an initiative. So I don't think that the committee really felt that we could or should give all the details or even a legal opinion as to how this could be handled. I understand that it's probably, in many people's minds, once something has qualified for the ballot, it may not be within the purview of the petitioners to withdraw it, and I can understand the reasoning for that. So some mechanism would have to be arrived at, perhaps a pre-qualification and then final qualification after it goes through the legislature or whatever. But yes, that is one of the things that has to be worked out, because we would want something that is acceptable to those who have initiated it to be able to be withdrawn from the ballot. Even if it couldn't be withdrawn, you would of course have a situation where, in the example you're having right now, if Mr. Mannix or people supporting that felt your alternative was okay, they'd simply tell their supporters not to vote for the first one. And that has happened in Oregon. We have, I believe, I can't cite the date or the initiative number, but there has been, maybe some of you remember, a couple of initiatives that were deemed inconsistent with each other, and it was held that the one garnering the larger number of votes would become law.
Correct. And one more question, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. On your recommendation number 7, that would require ballot measures to be submitted to legislative council. When I first looked at it, my concern was, I can't remember the number of attorneys that we have in the office, but there's a lot of creative minds in the state of Oregon, and if every creative mind had access to legislative council, they'd be working 24/7 to try to clarify the different ideas that were proposed. Did you discuss some trigger mechanism?
We talked about that a little bit, and I think in wasn't it House Bill 2082 that raised the number of signatures to 2,500 for ballot titles? So you could do something similarly with this legislative council, I suppose. We stated it in terms of prior to circulation, and I realize that what we're saying now would be somewhat different. There might be some degree of circulation of the general concept or of a first draft, but that's just up to you to work out a trigger. But I think we did envision that there would probably have to be something like that.
The threshold now is 1,000 signatures. You have to produce 1,000 signatures before you get a ballot title, and the original proposal had been 10% of the signatures that were necessary to qualify for the ballot. So
previously, wasn't it 25?
We did strike a compromise.
But
actually, that isn't applicable to getting the drafting services of legislative council. That's to getting the ballot title actually written through the ballot title process. And following up on Representative Buckley's question, I think maybe one sort of incremental step is just publicizing the fact that the drafting services of legislative council are available to any citizen right now, and the threshold, I think, is remarkably low. I thought it was 25 electors, but maybe it's 50. Just have to sign something saying they would like to use legislative council. I'm not sure that our capable people who are working so hard right now on all the measures we're giving them would be thrilled to have more citizens coming in, but in fact, I know I have directed people there when they wanted to get things drafted. So I think one thing we could do is just let people know that that's available without necessarily requiring it. Certainly be a step toward...
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we put it on the Oregon Channel this morning.
Right. We have certainly done that. Representative Galizia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just heard a collective thud underneath the building. A lot of fainting attorneys in the building. They just... I'm glad that Representative Buckley brought up the... Well, actually, I think you brought up the idea, the specific example that has happened with the Property Crimes Initiative. I think the indirect initiative that you advocate makes a lot of sense. And instead of having backroom deals, which is what we're having now, we would be having a deliberative discussion of the property crimes proposal, and I think that would be much better, and we might have a similar outcome, because it seems like one of the great things about the initiative process is, and it's often been called the gun behind the door. Yeah. If we fail to act and we're not putting something on the agenda, members of the public can do that, and so I think the indirect initiative would do what a lot of proponents want, but it would do it in a more deliberative way. So I appreciate that. And I really appreciate the fact that there's a lot of focus on the procedure. I'm sure everyone here with different political ideologies can look at certain initiatives and say, well, I don't like the outcome of that initiative, so I don't like the process. But it really shouldn't be so much conservative, liberal. It's kind of the process itself is really critical going forward. So that's what I love about this report. So I had a question for clarification. On your chart about all the different states on pages 16 and 17 of this report, there are several states, our neighbors in Washington and Utah. Well, I shouldn't say several. There are just two that you say under statutory, direct and indirect.
Right.
So could you explain in terms of your categorization what that means?
Yes. Every state is different, and we have some data that isn't in here about exactly how each state does it. Washington is one of two states that gives the petitioner the choice. So they can go first to the legislature or directly to the voters. So the indirect that we're recommending is not the one that Washington has. Ours, if you're looking for a state that has is a model for what we're talking about, the closest would be Maine and Massachusetts. Washington, and I think Utah might be the other one that have this voter or petitioner option. And it was interesting to look at the data on that, if I might cite that, which is that it's been pretty consistent through the last three or four decades that the great majority of initiatives in Washington go directly to the voters. But there have been, I suppose for strategic reasons, there have been initiatives, even in recent years, that have the petitioners have chosen to send first to the legislature. And I think that relates to what you were speaking about, Representative Galizio, because if you think about the process as not just being a process, but also having an impact on what precedes that process, that you might find between the indirect and the legislative council change that we're talking about, you might find petitioners just sitting down with legislators or with that committee or with leaders in that area in the legislature and working out a proposal, knowing that it's going to go there in the first instance, and it would change the process that way, just knowing that it has to be vetted, if you will, by the legislature, and that you could put out a competing item, which they may not want to have happen. Likewise, the whole idea that we need to have the initiative wide open because sometimes the legislature just doesn't solve issues, as Madam Chair was noting a few minutes ago, that even you have used that. Well, in states where there is no initiative, I think some people working there would have the opinion in looking at Oregon that, in fact, knowing that it exists all the time is part of why you didn't get those things through, or that, in fact, the legislature, in the absence of the initiative option, might, or say a more, somewhat more restrictive initiative that might be something which would be an incentive for the legislature to make some difficult choices and some compromises which now might not always be made. That's a matter of opinion. So I don't speak for the committee in voicing that opinion, but it's certainly one we've heard, including from some members of your own body in their unguarded moments, considered that maybe the presence of the initiative system in Oregon is somewhat of a deterrent to the legislature for having to solve some of those toughies. That's for you to think about, but just wanted to note that it's sort of an indirect effect of these processes themselves.
Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first of all, I am one that reluctantly likes to change our Constitution. In fact, you'll see with my voting here on this committee, I think the Constitution should not be changed like you change your socks. I've noticed a change. I've been in this state all my life, and I've noticed a heck of a change in the last 10, 20 years with the initiative process. I don't recall very many back in the 50s or the 60s. Of course, I wasn't voting then, but my folks didn't talk about them. I don't remember a voter's pamphlet that looked like a telephone book either being sent to your house with all the initiatives. And the pros and the cons. What's interesting about the pros and the cons of that is the fact that one state's one thing, one state's the other. You have 15 different opinions this way, 15 different opinions this way, and yet they're completely contradictory to each other, and so what is the real truth? That's what confuses voters. I sense a sense of frustration with the voters today. We have to vote. How many initiatives are we going to vote on this time? I've heard that. I've had people call me up and say, what does this mean? That's not good. Because obviously we haven't kept to the KISS system, keep it simple, stupid. We've gotten so intricate with these wording that people don't understand the initiatives. And that's a crying shame in this state. The other thing that I'd like to see us do that I think that it's And I think it's partially irresponsibility on our part as legislators and not thinking on the part of the voters, and that is that you tie money to certain budgetary issues. I guess it's unconstitutional, we've been told, but when you have an initiative, the example, it says you will cut this X amount of taxes, okay, fine. Where does that money come from? Does that come out of the Department of Human Services? Does it come out of Senior Services? Does it come out of our mental hospitals, or where does it come out of our state police? Where's that money coming out? Well, we don't think about that because we think of the general fund. And it's very interesting that some people think that the general fund is just there and it's a bunch of money that you can just pull from. Unfortunately, when you pull from that general fund, you are pulling from someone's budget. But that's never... The nexus is never there for people to understand that. My colleague from Ashland here mentioned about a sales tax. And we do have a proposal, and it's not necessarily just a sales tax, but it's actually a cut of taxing for people at work and the people that own property. And it recoups monies from the underground and tourism. But we had two focus groups, and it was very interesting, these focus groups, because it used to be when you talked about a sales tax to an Oregonian, their hair would catch on fire, their ears would melt shut, and their brain would go in neutral. They didn't want to talk about it. But these focus groups, and there was two separate ones, they didn't jump up and scream and holler. They said, well, it's time we needed to talk about it. But the real thing that came out of that was a lack of trust for this body. They trust us as far as they can throw this building. And I'll tell you why. The example in that group came out was this. California started with a 3% sales tax. Where in the state of California can you find a 3% sales tax? It doesn't exist. By the time the counties add on to it, the cities add on to it, and the state is up the ante, some places in California it's approaching a 9% distrust. So that's why the constitutional issue came up of how do you bulletproof it for that because of that lack of trust. The process is probably the most important thing that we need to preserve, because if you tamper with the process, you have to be very careful with the cause and effect and ask yourself what's been. So I appreciate what you've done, the work you've done, and I think it doesn't matter whether you're conservative, a liberal, a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, or whatever. This is about Oregon, and this is very near and dear to everyone's heart. But more importantly, we don't want to break the system that we have, but maybe make the system better, and I appreciate your work.
Just to back up your contention that you don't remember much about the initiative being used in the 50s and 60s, between 1950 and 1969, a total of 21 initiatives were proposed.
Okay.
From 1990 to 1999, one decade, 56.
There you go.
So it's almost triple.
Well. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I just want to make the comment that you stated in here that it's barring your conclusions, number five specifically, that poorly drafted measures produce unintended consequences. And I just wanted to add that that is certainly not the sole territory of an administrative process. And we certainly spend a lot of time in this body fixing past mistakes. But I do want to ask a question. I do want to comment about that as well. But I was wondering if there's any discussion around legislative referrals and ballot titles. Right now, ballot titles that can be drafted essentially by the proponents in the legislature make it to the ballot, whereas initiatives from citizens have to go through a big process and get neutral language and hear the pros and cons, and they go through a completely different process. And I wonder if there's been any discussion around making those processes similar.
No. We don't recall any in our committee, and none of the legislative members that testified to us brought that up. It's a good question. Yeah.
I suspect part of that might have been timing. It really did surface as a more prominent issue connected with Measure 50, I believe it was, and in our research had
49.
I'm sorry, 49. And our research had been wrapped up at that point.
Great question. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think part of what your presentation and your report have shown to me is that the, you know, an initiative just doesn't appear. It's not an organic process whereby, because the legislature didn't do its job, the people magically rise up and bring something forward. It's really anybody with $300,000 and meticulously poll-tested language can get something on the ballot, and that's often how those things happen, with one person giving $300,000. I guess my question is, within the framework that you've had, one of the challenges we have is when an initiative passes, there's no funding mechanism attached, and this is similar to what Representative Esquivel mentioned. So, you know, the cost of something might be $256 million, but there's no revenue attached to it, and there's no description of where the cuts would have to come. Within your framework, would there be a way to incorporate where the trade-offs might come in this, or would that just be something that would be identified by the committee that reviewed the measures?
Well, the City Club Committee in this report did not go so far as to make a recommendation that would change that fact. We considered it. You'll notice in these tables that it's not uncommon for other states to limit initiatives. In other words, their constitutions limit initiatives so that they cannot appropriate or expend monies without providing a tax. Nevada, our bordering state, is probably the clearest example. So I would say that we didn't necessarily expect that the legislature would be limited to the proposals that are in here, and that the issue you're talking about is certainly one that is on many people's minds, and we documented the problems in here, including, as I mentioned, bond rates, because we could impose a $256 million cost out of the blue and not provide new revenues. That is according to, I think it was Moody's that was quoted by our research people. That is one reason Oregon's bond ratings for all general obligation bonds are lower. Not for anything that's currently on the books, but because of the fear of what could happen in the future. So, again, the City Club didn't choose to make that recommendation, although it was considered, but certainly it would be something that you might. It would probably require a constitutional amendment to change the process whereby you make that type of limitation. But there, you can find several states that do it.
Thank you. And we're almost out of time. I guess I'll take the chair's prerogative of asking the last question, and then you can offer any closing comments. I think one of the criticisms that is made a lot these days about the initiative process is that people are using it to put things on the ballot, really not whether they care to get them passed or not, but simply as sort of offensive measures so that various groups, whether they're unions or other organized groups, will have to spend money just to fight those measures, and that'll divert resources that could be used either to put other measures forward or to elect candidates or to just give money to the Salvation Army or do something else good with it. So do you have any comments about that use of the process, and do you see any ways in which your proposals might address that or try to restore this to a more proactive process?
I think a number of our measures would mitigate the number of measures that make it to the ballot, and those that would be there would, I would say, probably be more thoughtful and more legitimate, and those changes right there, I believe, would probably take some of the political efficacy out of putting initiatives on the ballot for something less than sincere reasons.
It's really hard to think of proposals to address what people's motives are, though, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's precisely why we didn't draw a conclusion on this, because it's so very subjective. But we certainly heard a lot of testimony suggesting that people were putting measures on the ballot for ulterior motives.
So we'll just let you wrap up and share any thoughts, and then obviously you'll be able to continue the discussion this afternoon in the Senate election.
The final thought is just that our our main purpose is really to stimulate this discussion, and it's been very gratifying to hear the beginning here this morning in your chambers, and hope that you'll have this dialogue with your fellow members who haven't been able to hear us directly. And we have more copies of this report to send people, which we will be happy to do. And thank you again. Thank you very much.
We are available to any of you if you want to discuss this further.
That's great. Well, thanks very much for all the work that you put into this, and I'm sure this will be a continuing discussion.
Thank you.
And, yes, Representative Thatcher?
I just have a question for you.
Okay.
The chair. And that would be, are we planning to have any vetting of this, further vetting of this, get groups that would be affected by this coming in? And
that's certainly a possibility. We don't have many hearing opportunities remaining to our committee, but we may be able to after next Thursday, Thursday when we're done with committee work on bills. And this morning we were going to have a presentation. We didn't have time for on the implementation of House Bill 2082. So we could certainly have other people come and testify in response to the ideas that we've heard. And members, I mentioned earlier that we will be meeting on Friday morning at 8:30. And Representative Thatcher, you'll want to check that agenda closely, because I think one of your measures is posted for hearing then. And we have a couple of other bills, and then I expect we will be pretty busy for the next few days after that. So, members, with nothing further to come before us, committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.